Before we start this podcast, we would like to take the opportunity to mention that we now have a Patreon page where you can help to support, evolve and continue these compassionate conversations. Please visit patreon.com/vocedialogues for more information. Listen!
Welcome everyone to the Voce Dialogues, Voices of Compassionate Evolution. I'm Chloe Goodchild, founder of The Naked Voice, and this is our new online community where we are exploring, deepening, and evolving our awareness of the transforming power of compassion. Enjoy these new dialogues with a wide range of artists, musicians, writers and philosophers, social entrepreneurs and sacred activists. They are all visionaries, transforming lives through the art of conscious creative expression with practices inspired by their own unique life experience. The Voce Dialogues are dedicated to the compassionate evolution of life on Earth. Well, hi, everyone. Welcome to the Voce Dialogues. And it's my great joy to be in conversation with Charles Eisenstein and Bayo Akomolafi. Hello to you both.
Hello, Chloe. Happy to be here.
Great. Hello, hello.
Brilliant. Well, those of you that aren't so familiar with these two extraordinary guys, I'm just going to introduce them a little. So Bayo Akomolafi, PhD, is rooted with the Yoruba people. He's the father of Alethea and Kia, and the grateful life partner to Ije, son and brother. A widely celebrated international speaker, post-humanist thinker, poet, teacher, public intellectual, essayist, and author of two books, These Wilds Beyond Our Fences, Letters to My Daughter on Humanity's Search for Home. And we will tell our own story. The Lions of Africa Speak. Bayo Akomolafi is the visionary founder of the Emergence Network and host on the online post-activist course, We Will Dance with Mountains. Charles Eisenstein is the father of four, an essayist, speaker, and the author of several books, including The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. It would be just really wonderful just to hear both of you just to share with us, because I know you both know each other very well. You were just sharing over 10 years that you've known each other. I've just really enjoyed hearing the two of you in communication online in various contexts. And it would be just beautiful to hear what has inspired your relationship and your friendship. What drew you towards each other? And what part did sound and spoken word play in that? Because you're both two masters of the spoken word. So how did that all come about?
Well, let the student speak first, and then the master will speak later.
For one thing, our first spoken conversation, I don't think happened until probably a few years after our first written correspondence. I'm not sure exactly what the timeline was. Maybe not that many years. Do you remember, Bayo?
No, I don't know. I think the first time we actually spoke was in Byron Bay as well.
I don't know how Bayo would describe it, but I felt a sense of very deep alliance when I got to know Bayo.
Yeah.
I don't know. Some people you just trust automatically, instinctually. And Bayo's been one of those people. Also, we respect each other tremendously, and we also don't take each other that seriously in a way, which also comes from, well, there's truth in humor that can rarely be found anywhere else these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Much needed, huh?
Yeah. For me, it was trust was... I remember sitting at a table with Charles in Portland or Byron Bay, Charles. I can't remember where it was, but there was a sense that we were, I think we expressed it this way, that we were both seeded by an alien civilization or something like that. And we were deposited on the planet. It was a sense of a distinct kinship with the otherwise, if you will. That there was a lot of, yeah, trust is just a small part of it, but there was also story and trickery and humor. Yes, I think this is the first time we're actually saying the, I don't think of the world in terms of the actual history. I think history is a lot more fugitive than we give it credit for. But this is the first time we're sharing with you, Chloe, or anyone, the actual, so to speak, history of how we met. Maybe it was your spectacles, your glasses that compelled the truth from us, but it was, we usually tell deferring and never-ending fabulations about that. And I guess there's a sense in which even saying that I met Charles 10 years ago feels abusive to the relationship.
Wow. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Trying to contain it in this space history, time. You know.
Yeah.
And we all know how malleable history is. I actually just wrote an essay touching on this about how histories themselves can change as we step from one timeline into another. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so to try to contain truth in a set of linear objective facts always ends up reducing the truth. I mean, I can see how as I evolve as a person, as bio evolves, as our relationship evolves, maybe our past also evolves. Yeah. And the story that we just told you becomes no longer even factual.
Yeah. You know, observing and witnessing and listening to you both is that this incredible camaraderie that goes on between you that is so deeply and sincerely felt that, you know, you can really feel completely at home with you both. It's just so great to hear two guys in that kind of communion with each other, if you like.
Yeah.
It would seem as if storytelling is really central in both your lives in different ways. But that plays a key role in the way that you're delivering what you understand. Charles, when you're sharing your thoughts, for example, it's like you are telling a story and the words just seem to come out of your mouth very spontaneously, as if you haven't planned anything. And yet what comes out always sounds so completely coherent. And I'm just wondering, how has this happened for you?
Okay. Yeah.
It's really my labor. I do the scripts, right? And the script writing for him behind the scenes. I'm actually the genius. And then he pretends like, oh, this is just coming out of source.
So he's got a little kind of microphone in his ear or something or whatever.
Yeah, man, okay. For everything.
Yeah. Although it's not quite as he describes. I mean, usually I'm just channeling. Bio, you know.
Yep. Yeah. True that.
I am but the vessel.
I see. Is there any kind of two-way thing with this, or is it mainly that way?
No. It's I'm telling you. It's
but you know, to answer your question, Chloe, have you ever like gone into a conversation with somebody and you've planned out beforehand everything you're gonna say?
Actually, I can't say that I have.
Okay. Well, a lot of, I've tried that before.
Yeah.
And it doesn't usually go very well.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I end up usually not saying all the things I plan to say anyway. So that's why I've kind of given up on that. And I approach public speaking in the same spirit of a conversation in the sense that I don't know what I'm going to say until I'm saying it to you.
Great.
I don't know you. And if I erect a statue of you in my mind and then go speak to that statue, you're going to be like, hold on, who are you even talking to?
Right.
Which is why if a speaker, like say, memorizes a speech or has a spiel with their PowerPoint that they do every single time, the audience will have the feeling that they're not really speaking to them and have a feeling of inauthenticity. So really, that's all I'm doing. In a normal conversation with one-on-one, most people have no problem speaking spontaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really what it, for me, what it is. It's just tuning into the person or the group, the audience or whatever that I'm speaking to, which is why it's a bit harder to do it online, actually, for me.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. But it's tuning into them. You know, if I can see their faces, it's easier. But I've learned, actually, in the era of COVID to engage more subtle senses and tune in. What I say, it's the product of a relationship.
Yeah, I hear that. You know, you're both speaking from such a place of authenticity. And it's interesting you should talk about public speaking versus speaking just informally here. You know, one level, we're speaking, we're getting to know each other. The theme is spoken sound, sound, spoken voice, what part that's played in our lives. What I notice is in my world, where I've been exploring the human voice, the authentic voice, how we find that, is that if I ask a person, you know, how do you feel about your voice? They will say, I haven't got one. And in fact, I've taken it to the point of even standing at the bottom of escalators and singing to people as they're coming down the escalator, and they're completely sort of disconvolvulated as to who they may be seeing and who is this woman, because I'm so fascinated in why it is that so many people feel they haven't got a voice. And I'd love to explore that with you both, because it seems as if we've created a world where, in my experience of people, is that we've created a world and cultures that have separated speaking from singing, for example, and then separated silence from speaking from singing, as if they're separate realities. And then singing is mainly, unless you're blessed to be brought up in indigenous culture or a very coherent village world, the singing basically just is kind of relegated over to a small minority of trained musicians who then become like performers on a stage. And they then are required to entertain or to impress, to perform, right? And suddenly there's that sense of separateness from the audience. The audience is sitting there passively receiving and expecting, you know, they've paid money to come and hear somebody impress them or entertain them in some way. And that's been taken to such ludicrous proportions. Like we have the X Factor in Britain. And I think there are similar things in America, right? Where you have these like 19 million people watching a TV program of one godforsaken individual who's going to be paid a lot of money to be the voice of the year kind of thing. It's just so fascinating to me that we, so many people have this experience just in ordinary everyday life of being dissociated from their authentic voice. And I mean, by that, I mean the voice like we're using now to speaking, getting to know each other. And that's so fascinating to me. I mean, occasionally, like my Russian teacher at school, for example, she was so embodied. The voice was so embodied. And she was so passionate about the Russian language. It was just so incredible to be in her presence, because she really did transmit this absolute love of poetry and philosophical thought and literature. And, you know, it was amazing. But I think that's quite rare. It just has concerned me for many years, I suppose, which is why I've been exploring this territory for so many years, as to why it is that so many people feel they haven't got a voice. And more so now, since we've been, like the last 2 years, we've been masked and all kinds of things. You know, that's almost like it's such a metaphor for not having a voice or not being allowed to have a voice. You know, it's sort of reached that kind of level of intensity for many people.
I think voice is ecological in the sense it's more than just being the performance of one individuated body. Right. Mm. More than just being the particular feature or property of a body, it feels atmospheric, so that in a sense you could scream all you want and be dependent on the political contexts. You know, you could be voiceless even though you're screaming, and you could be silent in a different cultural situation, and there is more agency. You know, there is freedom even in the silence, and so that, you know, like I said, it feels more ecological, like a sonic arrangement, more than just an individuated response. And so there's a slight cultural divergent response, you know, to what Charles said earlier. Charles is a master at speaking just in the moment. Mm-hmm. And we've had many funny moments, you know, we're a trio, you see. And so when we, there's another brother of ours. And so when three of us are in the same environment and we're speaking in the same context, you know, Charles goes on the stage and he's basically just, I didn't prepare anything. I'm just going to speak in a moment. Whereas Manish and I are probably doing our PowerPoint slides, you know. there's something to say about the different conversational contexts that allow for different kinds of speaking. In Yoruba land, in Nigeria, there are different performances of voice, sometimes materialized as a call and response relationship that seem performative and theatrical to someone who is an outsider. And it kind of creates this audience feel, but it's a very temporal, you know, it's a very situated contract that we will be silent for this moment. And we expect you to have done your work. We expect you to dance and perform, jump through the hoops for us in this moment. And we will applaud and be joyous in this moment together with you. And then when this is done, the elders will bless you. So there are ritualized conversational contexts that may differ from the immediacy that Charles is speaking about, and which I also value. I value that. I found it increasingly difficult to do that, as well as Charles, you know, in this Zoom era that we're in, because I like to see the face. The face is part of my food when I'm in the speaking moment. But there are differences. They're different, and there are different needs given the time, given the moment that is called to be.
Yeah. And I want to just say, like, I don't think that just because somebody's using PowerPoint or has carefully prepared a speech, that doesn't mean that they're not also in the moment connecting with the audience.
Right.
Because, you know, it's a difference between reciting something that you've memorized and actually speaking it to
that
person. Like you have it with musical performances too. Whatever band is playing, maybe they are playing songs that they've already written, but you can tell the difference. Sometimes they're really singing to you and you can feel it. Other times, maybe they're just kind of going through their material. It's not so much like how you've prepared it and stuff, but it is the authenticity that you're talking about, Chloe, is a function of actually being in relationship.
Yes. I really hear what you're both saying, and that there is, when someone has an incredible gift and they've written songs and they love to share them, it can be just the most moving thing that ever happened. And then if you're blessed to be born into a culture where ceremony and rites of passage are still really alive, you know, in that culture, in the culture in England, it's like, it's very, very lost. You know, we have a lot to account for in terms of raiding other cultures and diminishing them. I suppose a lot of that, the whole kind of the impact of dominance and old paradigm control has had quite an impact also, hasn't it, really, in the way people use their voices or don't use their voices. I mean, it's quite interesting that the voice of protest, for example, has come out in no uncertain terms in the last 2 years, and that has been felt and seen, whether or not it was on the media. And that I find really quite fascinating, but that can be counterproductive as well. I don't know whether either of you have anything to say about that, what your sense of that is.
Charles and I are both fans of Tolkien. Charles has read the entire thing. I'm still on my way through it. But of course, the mythology, the cosmology is beautiful, you know, and it starts out with sound, right? It starts with music. This creation is not to be seen apart from sound, the production of song. Eru Iluvata sings a song and invites agency to perform the song along with him. And I like that idea of sound being, or in a sense, we being created by sound, not just the other way around, right?
Mm.
That we produce sound, but sound produces us. So that in some sense, you might even say that space-time is not enough. Maybe it should be hyphenated even further. So it's space-time sound, that there is a sense in which we inhabit sonic landscapes, that temporalities are not to be seen apart from sound, and not just human sound, but sound as an ecological, atmospheric, libidinal quality that is sensuous and alive and moving and material and spiritual all at once. So you might, you know, I was reading some research. I don't know exactly how far or deeply empirical this is, but this author writes about hip hop and how the production of those beats that is reminiscent of the mother's heart. And there's something about the beating of the heart and the babe in the stomach being close to that beating that makes hip hop some kind of matrixial or amniotic space, an invitation to stay, to go back into the womb, if you will. That I've always loved that interpretation, that it, more than just the text and the words in any hip hop song, that there's something about the beats that is an invitation to cuddle.
Gorgeous. I love that. You might be interested to know there's this guy called John Stuart Reed. I don't know whether you've come across him yet, but he invented something called the cymoscope. I've known him
from
cymoscope. Yeah, it's an instrument that enables us to be able to see sound visually. So the cymoscope basically absorbs the sound through water, and then the impact of the vibrations and so on are transmitted onto a screen, so you can see the whole thing. He's done this extraordinary thing of actually testing out the impact of different kinds of sound, like hip-hop, opera, folk, and Tibetan overtoning. And he's tried this out actually on in vitro blood cells, so that he's got a kind of experiment going inside a little machine where these blood cells are responding to the impact of the vibration of the music. Oh my God.
Interesting.
It is mind blowing. And what really blew his mind more than anything, blood cells, absolutely as you describe, love the beat. You think like maybe classical music they're going to really love because it's like lovely and serene, maybe, you know. But the reality is that the beat, this rhythmic sound, they were literally becoming redder than red. And so what he's actually demonstrating is this connection, this extraordinary connection between sound and matter and the blood, the very blood that is in our bodies, and how sound is such an essential medicine for it.
Right.
Mm. Maybe I'll just weave a couple of things together here. The somatoscope you're talking about, it makes really visible this idea that Bio was, you know, referring to with Tolkien, that that the world is sung into existence, spoken into existence, or that it arises from vibration. I mean, this is actually not even scientifically a problem.
Exactly.
Many religions, Christianity, in the beginning was the word, Hinduism, the idea of the primordial Om.
Yes.
Taoism, actually, the Tao. In Chinese, the word Tao can actually also mean to speak. Even in many other cultures too, believed and many still believe that their songs are part of the maintenance of the world.
Beautiful, yeah.
And if they lose these traditions and lineages, then the world will fall apart. And you know what? I have to say, kind of seems to be happening.
Right.
As so many cultures have disintegrated and lost their songs, it kind of does seem like the world is falling apart.
Right.
And so maybe we need to recover these lost technologies of creation. And I think that some of the churches some of these buildings are specifically designed in order to amplify the generative power of sound.
Right.
We don't even know how to build them today. Like there's so much lost technology embodied in these exquisite buildings where we've become very primitive.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I could add, I'd piggyback just on that. Thanks, brother. I was invited to say a few things to speak at a gathering of people who are rejuvenating or resuscitating the Irish language, Gaelic, together with its spiritualities. And you know, what was intriguing about this invitation to share about language and voice and sound and the word was that along with the emergence of this Gaelic or re-emergence and people wanting to speak the language again, was this spirituality of the language, right? There it wasn't just about learning new words. It was about noticing its connection with trees and the ecological impasses of the moment, the troubles around us.
Right.
A new language wants to be passed around. We need to infect each other with new ideas and new concepts. And so we need a new tongue for that. And in my discussions with these beautiful people, I remember saying that even the desire to learn a new language is already the language. That there is a sense in which language is much more than words. You know, it's much more than syntax and grammar and a particular arrangement in sentences. It's much more than that. That there's something else, I dare say, molecular.
Yeah.
About voice and language. The Yoruba people were losing our language. It's one of the endangered languages, according to UNESCO, I think. Yoruba people, there might not be any Yoruba language by the year 2050, is what some estimates are saying. And, you know, in response to that, our federal government instituted programs to revive the language. And so what they developed a new curriculum and they put it in schools, and so there are grades attached to it. And so students are passing and succeeding, and the government is like, yes, this is great, we're succeeding. Except that there's something oral about Yoruba, so that it becomes ironic that our very attempts to save the language actually kills it even further.
Oh, God. Right? Yeah.
Right. And because we've reduced it to the usual metrics that we're used to. It's now the language is now tethered to grades and grade point averages. Then we lose something in the moment.
Yeah.
But I like to believe that that language finds new life in ways that, you know, exceed human speakers.
Right?
So that in a sense, you know, even if every human speaker were wiped out of the Yoruba language and there was no one left. And I say this with a great sense of hesitation and humility, not trying to diminish the role of human speaking and how that is quite integral to language and its development and evolution.
Yeah.
But that even if we're to wipe out human speakers, that language is still find a way to live. Maybe to be carried by ants, you know, morsels of language will be carried into some depths and soil, and to find a way to reemerge or to become different.
Yes.
In a different way, right? So, yeah.
Oh, I love that. I absolutely love that. You may well have heard of that experiment that was done with cicadas, that their voices, right? When you actually slow down the frequencies of their sound, which is that very, very amazing high frequency sound that you hear, they're singing in perfect fifths. It's extraordinarily beautiful. It's so beautiful. What does that require of us as voices, as human voices, that we need to be, it calls us to be really attentive to how sound is coming out of our mouths, isn't it? And how each human being has the potential to allow this evolution of sound to take place, you know, that isn't just bound by the ancient languages, which clearly do carry very sacred energy, really. It's really honoring the languages as well as allowing for new languages to emerge, like a new language of consciousness that, for example, that isn't just in Western culture, at least, is not just dominated by the left side of the brain, but a language that comes from the whole brain, from the whole self, from the heart center. I tell you one thing that really blew my mind once was, I've worked a lot in Ireland, and one of my Irish students felt really inspired to go and work with the Piikani indigenous community up in the northern areas of Montana. And they were just these beautiful beings who I was lucky enough to meet. And we were just literally sitting with them and talking. And then, I mean, I could just see them beginning to look at me and observe me as a kind of white middle-class spiritual shopper, you know, coming in to steal information from them, as that kind of feeling, you know, a kind of reservation. And I remember them just talking to each other in their own language. And I remember I was just asking them about the skills that are required linguistically and within their different forms of communication that are required to really sustain coherence in the community. And they eventually just said to me, well, we cannot carry on this conversation with you any further till we've heard your sound. And so I said, okay, wow. Yeah, I would love that. I'd love to hear your sound. And so they said, right, follow us. And in the middle of the night, we were just driving through and end up at their house in the dark. And then suddenly I'm like sat at the other end of the room, and they just say, right, sing. And it was an incredible moment, because not only a privilege to be there, but also like just so, as you can imagine, just so completely out of any experience anywhere I'd ever been. And so I just heard this chant that I've sung for many, 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 many years, which is I received in India, which is just singing, you know, to the mother of the universe, because they'd been telling me all these incredible stories about how they communicate with the bears and how they negotiate with the bears as to who's going to eat the blueberries first and all those kind of things, and seasonal things, and how they relate with nature in so many ways. And so I just started singing this chant, and I just started singing, Om Anandamayi Chaitanya Mayi Satya Mayi Paramesh Wadi Om, and so on. I just sat, was just singing, just very gently. But this chant that I absolutely love singing, that just really recalibrates my whole system and unites me with the cosmos and the ground. And when I opened my eyes, they were right in my face, staring at me as if I was some kind of scientific specimen, because they couldn't quite understand how that sound was coming out of that mouth, out of this person. And so they were studying me like that, and they just said, where did you get that from? And I said, what do you mean, where did I get that from? They said, that sound, we don't understand how you know that sound. It's the same rhythm, the same melody line, the same vibration as in one of our high pipe ceremonies. And we thought that was secret. So I don't know what you make of that. It was just amazing, because we just all fell on each other's shoulders, and we were just deeply, deeply, deeply connected, as if we'd just literally lived together all our lives. It was an incredible moment of unicity, and just realizing that this apparent Sanskritic language, which had been given to me 15 years previously by a devotional friend in San Francisco, had then found its way into their home, was suddenly brought us all together. Mm. It just brought up for me the whole question of what is secret? and secret meaning sacred that doesn't belong to everyone. It was a profound moment, you know, of just realizing the power of sound itself to bring people together in that way. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
I'm not a scholar of Sanskrit. I wasn't singing it probably in the right way in that sense. But I suppose there is a music that just comes out of each of us that is there in each of us, that is to be found, that is seeking to be found, or something like that.
Well, I'm thinking about secrets. Mm-hmm. Normally we understand them as things that must not or should not be told. But originally, a secret is something that cannot be told. If you tell it in the wrong place, in the wrong time, you're not actually telling it. You're telling some counterfeit version of it, because right. The truth is, again, a relationship. It's in a connection. It's in a moment. So if you try to sing that song or teach that song or tell a secret story outside of the appropriate intimate context,
right,
then you're actually telling a different story, even if every word is the same and every tone is the same, because you're telling it into a different listening. So a song like that, like the High Pipe song, it becomes a like degraded caricature of itself when it is taken outside the fullness of that context. Mm. And this is an understanding that part of an understanding that Bio was referring to this before, that a language is not just its semantics. A language is emphatically not a system of signs, which is what the left brain thinks that it is. And
right.
That you can decode it, you can understand it, if you only know what this means and what that means, what all of these signs means and the rules for putting them together, then you know the language, right?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm.
Because you're missing all of the things that escape the finite set of semiotic categories, the intonation. And that, because it cannot be captured in a finite system of signs, like, where does it come from? It's not a representational structure. It doesn't represent, it doesn't mean something, it is something. And this is a sense like any ancient language, but even modern languages, that's why my dog can understand me. She's not listening to the semantics, but mm-hmm. she can hear, and dogs can actually distinguish between different languages too. And then, you know, taking it back to the music, mm-hmm. to the beat, the power of music is not because of what it means. It's because of what it is, because it is physical.
Mm-hmm.
Music is physical.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why I agree that, like, in some, like what Bio was saying, in some sense, languages can never be lost, because they don't exist only in human representational memory. Another friend of ours, Orland Bishop, says that they are emanations of the land itself,
mm-hmm.
which is why when people move to a new place, like every place in America has its own version of English. Mm-hmm. Like, how does that happen?
Right.
It's integral. And I think in some way, it's actually, if it weren't for mass media, then it might revert over time back to something very similar to what the indigenous languages had been in those places before.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't be able to understand it semantically necessarily, but you would recognize it as kindred. This is of a place.
Well, that was what blew my mind, I think, really. It was sort of a collapsing of dimensions. All of us were just astonished. We hadn't intended anything like that to happen. Do you know what I mean? It was just, we were just sharing our heart song, sharing ourselves with each other with great interest and also, but with great attention. I think that's what blew my mind about that, because it just seemed to open us up to each other and with each other, you know, in ways that otherwise might not have been possible. But what a mystery, you know, it's like, where did that come from?
Yeah.
And you think about the Tibetan language and mantra and how the diaspora of the whole Tibetan world and how that has blessed people that never even knew about mantra before. Yes. And that have found themselves blessed to be on the receiving end of that sound that is a recurring sound, like you were saying earlier, Bio, with the, you know, sounds that have that call and refrain as well. Mm-hmm. Because that has been really profound, hasn't it?
Maybe I'll just add this, Chloe. That, sorry to interrupt. Charles was saying about, and you were echoing it too, the physicality, the materiality, the molecularity of language and sound. And I think it's really important, this conversation, because we are trying to learn the language of the next, right? Of the otherwise.
Right. And yes.
There is a contemporaneous activism that might insist we need to find a blueprint. And if we can learn and colonize the next before we march into it, then we can actually inhabit it. Right. Hmm. And this might be what some might call a left-brained approach. But I think learning a new language requires a certain kind of vulnerability, and openness that I am struggling with, you know, as a Nigerian living in India. And I've lived in this country for 7 years now. And I've been married to my dear Indian wife for 11 years now. And I don't speak Tamil. Which is a beautiful language. Difficult. Yeah, but Charles speaks Chinese, right?
and really?
I don't. Wow. Yeah, he does. He does. Uh-huh. One of the things I don't like him for. but you know, this happened to me recently, and it just emphasizes what we're already saying. My wife and I were driving or riding her scooter. She was riding. I don't know how to ride a scooter yet, but she was riding the scooter. And one of our practices is just to give food to people around us, right? Coming from this idea that one doesn't eat or feed one's own stomach. You have to be fully fed and nourished. You feed those around you. So for 3-day events, so to speak, we just ride around, and my wife gets up early in the morning, 8 a.m., and cooks a hot, beautiful meal, mostly rice. And then we go around and I hold it, and then we just distribute it. On this day, this was last week, we were giving people. Now, I usually give this to people with English, speaking English, which my wife wanted to challenge. And so she taught me the words. She said, why don't you try Tamil today? Speak to them. And so she gave me the word. She said, Papaku sapari. And I said, what does that mean? And she said, it means food for the child. So it's basically to anyone on the streets, any child you just see with a parent, you know, just offer food. Amazingly, they take it.
Awesome.
It's a gift.
Yeah.
They take it. And so I kept on reciting it to myself, Papaku sapari, Papaku sapari. And she said, you're getting it wrong. And I said, what am I missing? She said, they wobble. She didn't say it. She just did it in front of me as she was riding. And we can't see each other, but I'm wobbling my head. She said, say it with a wobble. When your head wobble, when you shake your head that way, then it's meaningful to them. And I don't like looking like a fool, Chloe. There's something deeply ingrained in me that tells me if I say something or do something in a particular way that people might take offense to, I might come off looking stupid. And I think that's one of my deepest fears and vulnerabilities. But I tried it anyway. the long story short, this is another story entirely, another epic. But doing that felt like participating and opening myself up to the language. I could see the people's smiles just bursting out of their faces when I wobbled my head that way.
Oh, brilliant.
There's this obvious foreigner that is speaking to us, and it's more than the words in that moment. Palpable porousness that is required to enter into the ecology of a new tongue. And I think that's a tongue is just a small part of what we're speaking about here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I like that you call it a tongue, though.
Yeah. So
that
what do you say? Yeah.
A tongue, you know, that conveys that it is a physical body thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I've experienced this too, Bio, like that when I speak a different language, I mean, here's another piece of the generative power of word, the world changes. When I'm immersed in a different language, my you know, Cartesian mind says, well, I see different things. I see the world differently. But a more indigenous part of myself recognizes that the world has changed when I speak of it in a different language, or when I speak in it in a different language. And people's faces change when they speak a different language over time, especially. Like when I was living in Taiwan, I could easily distinguish an American-born Chinese of Taiwanese ancestry who was visiting and didn't speak Chinese from a local person just by looking at their face.
Wow.
It was awesome. Yes.
Sound creates us.
Yes.
God. Right.
It's incredible, isn't it? If you to that kind of subtlety. And you speak Chinese, Charles?
Yeah, I lived in Taiwan for 9 years, was a translator and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I just feel like we're just opening up so many questions and reflections and insights about how sound touches us, sound from the ground of consciousness, how it touches us and how it has touched each of us in our lives. And I really just want to thank you both so much for having this conversation. And I hope that we can continue it somewhere else in time, but that I hope that it's served your lives and our lives and our listeners' lives to just really to be asking, who is speaking? That's very often a question that comes into my mind, or who is singing, or who speaks words with my mouth, as a kind of more like a kind of meditative practice, really, more than anything else. I wonder if I can just share a Pablo Neruda poem with you, which just goes, "We must pass through solitude and difficulty, isolation and silence, to find that enchanted place where we can dance our clumsy dance and sing our sorrowful song. But in that dance and in that song, the most ancient rites of our conscience fulfill themselves in the awareness of being human." So that is an English translation of a Pablo Neruda poem. And I would love another time, if it was ever possible, just to listen to your respective poems and your own poetry, because I know that that also finds its way into all your work together and individually. Thank you so much, both of you, for this moment together.
Thank you, Chloe.
Thank you, Chloe. It's great.